It's Wednesday. It's 1 o'clock. It's time for the Indie Media Radio London show, brought to you on Resonance FM 104.4, bringing protest stories direct from the streets, posted onto the indiemedia.org.uk newswire and to global indie media sites worldwide. We look forward to presenting your stories, so keep posting them to indiemedia.org.uk.
Hello and welcome to the show. It's Wednesday the 22nd of March and you're listening to the Indie Media Radio London on Resonance FM 104.4. In the studio we've got Sam and Alistair and we're just going to read you some stories and play some tracks. Coming up later on we've got the Confessions of an Economic Hitman, but first a story about France. Following our coverage last week about the escalating student-led protests in France against the new CPE employment law, it's been a busy week on the other side of the channel. The CPE is, of course, the new employment contract due to take effect in April. The CPE would allow firms to hire people aged under 26 for a two-year trial period, during which they could be easily dismissed without a reason. Last Thursday, the 16th, well over 300,000 people took part in protests throughout France as more universities were occupied, roads blockaded, and the town hall in Rennes was occupied. In Paris, up to 120,000 people protested, followed by clashes with police using tear gas, rubber bullets and water cannon. Around 150 arrests were made in Paris, bringing the total to around 300, with over 40 police injured. Then, on Saturday, a truly staggering figure of well over 1 million people, perhaps up to 1.5 million, protested across the country as trade unions put their weight behind the campaigns. Clashes with police were reported in many locations, including, of course, Paris, where hundreds fought police for around 2 hours. Most of the country's 85 universities remained partially or totally shut down by student strikes on Monday, and more than 300 secondary schools across the country were also affected. With such a show of force on the streets, the unions have now called for a general strike next week on Tuesday, the 28th of March. Yesterday was another student day of action. Over 40,000 took to the streets of Paris and thousands were again protesting throughout France, with more actions like the blocking of railways. Not a day passes, it seems, without major protest or disruption. Increasingly, school students are joining the protests and actions boosting the numbers, with Le Figaro reporting over 800 schools affected on Monday. Again, clashes with police were reported in many towns. Today, the CNT union has called for demonstrations, and tomorrow, Thursday the 23rd, is yet another student day of action. Protests are expected to continue for the coming week, leading up to the general strike next Thursday. For more, see the Indie Media website and check out the Libcom blog on libcom.org/blog. If you're in London, there's an eyewitness report about the evening tonight at 7 p.m. at the Square Occupied Social Centre, which is at 21 Russell Square, London, WC1.
Les taureaux s'ennuient le dimanche quand il s'agit de courir pour nous. Un peu de sable, du soleil et des planches, un peu de sang pour faire un peu de boue. Mais c'est l'heure où les épiciers se prennent pour Don Juan. C'est l'heure où les Anglaises se prennent pour Monterland. Qui nous dira à quoi ça pense, un taureau qui tourne et danse et s'aperçoit soudain qu'il est tout nu. Ah, qui nous dira à quoi ça rêve, un taureau dont l'œil se lève et qui découvre les cornes des cocus. Les taureaux s'ennuient le dimanche quand il s'agit de souffrir pour nous. Mais voici les picadors et la foule se venge. Voici les toreros, la foule est à genoux. Et c'est l'heure où les épiciers se prennent pour Garcia Lorca. C'est l'heure où les Anglaises se prennent pour la Carmen Sita. Les taureaux s'ennuient le dimanche quand il s'agit de mourir pour nous. Mais l'épée va plonger et la foule se penche. Mais l'épée a plongé et la foule est debout. C'est l'instant de triomphe où les épiciers se prennent pour Néron. C'est l'instant de triomphe où les Anglaises se prennent pour Wellington. Ah, est-ce quand on vend ta terre, les taureaux rêvent d'un enfer où brûleraient hommes et toréros défunts. Ah, ou bien à l'heure du trépas, ne nous pardonnerait-il pas en pensant à Carthage, Waterloo et Verdun, Verdun.
Following on from the France report, coincidentally here in the UK, Tuesday the 28th of March could also see strike action by up to 1.5 million workers across more than 9 different trade unions. The strike has been provoked by an attack on the local government pension scheme, with the Labour government planning to increase the age workers can retire at. March the 28th, 2006 could perhaps be the largest strike in Britain since the 1926 general strike. Britain has seen 20 years of defeats for the trade unions movement, as each group of strikers stood alone. The strike over pensions could be different, as it involves so many different groups of workers acting together. Certainly one to watch, and more action is promised after the 28th as well.
Okay, and that was a track called Peace from Hans Kernel's Mitha album.
On Saturday, while much of the TV media concentrated on France, March 18th was also an international day of mobilisation against the war and occupation in Iraq, making the 3-year anniversary of the war. Hundreds of demonstrations took place throughout the world demanding an end to the occupation in Iraq and protesting against a possible attack on Iran. In London, the Stop the War Coalition said 80 to 100,000 people marched through the streets. However, as usual, there was disagreement over numbers, with the police saying the turnout was as low as 15,000, a figure which was then printed in mainstream media across the world. Locally, protesters also took place in Glasgow, Newcastle and Dublin. In the US, tens of thousands took part in around 500 protests across the country, as well as multiple attacks of civil disobedience. Indie media centres around the world collected reports of demonstrations from hundreds of thousands of people. In Germany, the demands were often broadened to include protests against repression and/or the liberty of political prisoners. In the Arab world, the largest demonstration took place in Baghdad itself, with about 1 million participants, and the Syrian capital Damascus with over 200,000. Smaller ones took place in Beirut, Cairo, and other Arab cities. In the Tunisian city of Sfax, police stormed into a crowd of about 3,000 people and beat them with batons and truncheons, injuring at least 20. For more, see the Indymedia website.
Now, we're going to focus in on that disagreement between the figures that the police report of 15,000 and the figures that the organised report of 80 to 100,000. And to discuss that point, on the line, we've got Chris Nynam from Media Workers Against the War. Chris, are you there?
Hi, yeah, I am.
Fantastic. Okay, now, Chris, I understand you've written a formal letter of complaint to the BBC about their coverage of events on Saturday. What's that all about?
Well, the first thing is that, I don't know if anyone watched the news on Saturday night, but unbelievably, the BBC on the national news didn't even mention the demonstration. Now, I mean, they call themselves a public service broadcaster. This is really quite shocking, because partly it was a very big demonstration, and, you know, we can come on to the discussion about numbers. And partly, the Stop the War Coalition and the anti-war movement generally represents the opinion of the majority of people in this country, an opinion, by the way, which is not represented by any of the mainstream political parties, who obviously get, you know, loads of coverage on the BBC. For the BBC not to even mention the demonstration is frankly bizarre. They did, as you say, they covered the French demonstrations. They've given recently a lot of coverage to the pro-animal testing demonstrations, which have been literally a few hundred people. And then they just completely ignore, you know, what is a massive show of anti-war feeling in the centre of London. So something's going on here, and we're writing a letter which we already has been signed by some sort of leading journalists, and we're getting loads more journalists to and media workers to sign up to it. And, you know, we just simply have to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Yeah, I mean, it was ever thus, though, wasn't it? I remember back in the days of CND in the 80s, the wildly varying tally of reports of numbers. On a broader point, I mean, do you think it matters that there's how big the demonstration is? I mean, we've had demonstrations with over 1 million people on the streets of London against the war in the last couple of years, and I believe we've still got a war on in Iraq.
Of course, but I mean, you know, I understand that, but I mean, I suppose in a way, you know, the warning bells have got to start ringing if people in the movement or activists are saying the same thing, are effectively, you know, taking the same position as the media. I mean, the fact, in my opinion, that the BBC has either been instructed or has taken its own decision to ignore this demonstration is actually a proof that they do worry about the demonstrations, that they are concerned about mobilisations. You know, when people say to me, oh, we're just having another march, what's the point in that? I say, if you can bear it, next time Tony Blair is on TV, look into the man's eyes. Does he look like a man who has fulfilled his colonial fantasies? Does he look like the man at the top of his game? Of course not. He looks like someone whose political authority has been drained away. I think that's because of the war, fundamentally, primarily. Mm. And I think that's because of the anti-war movement. I mean, you know, we were all rightly excited about February the 15th and taken up by the spirit of it. But it would have been incredible if we managed to stop the war with one demonstration. Mm. We have had a sustained campaign, the biggest campaign in British political history, the biggest social movement Britain has ever seen, that has constantly hounded Tony Blair. You know, when George Bush came over, we had hundreds of thousands of people in the streets. Condoleezza Rice is coming up to Liverpool. Next week, we're having a massive protest in Liverpool and in Blackburn. The fact that the movement hasn't gone away, that actually at the moment the movement is growing, has actually been the reason why, or one of the main reasons why, Tony Blair is in political freefall now. And that the whole imperial project, this new project for the new American century, is itself in crisis. So I think we need to be very careful before we say that mass mobilisations don't work. We haven't beaten them yet, but I tell you what, last time we had a demo, September the 24th, we were on the back foot after the bombings. It was quite hard for us, the movement. Now, there's no question they are in disarray. We are on the offensive. Bush and Blair are both in political crisis, and we've got to make the most of that. So I think demonstrations do matter. I think they definitely do matter.
Chris, you were at the demonstration on Saturday, I presume.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and what was your estimate of the size? I mean, I was at the back of the demonstration, right at the back, actually, with a Samba outfit, and I could certainly see from Hyde Park Corner along to Piccadilly was completely full of people.
Yeah.
And Trafalgar Square, although the lines are being renovated and there's quite a big hoarding up around them, Trafalgar Square was still fairly full. And of course, you never quite know how many people stick around for the rally.
Exactly.
But, it's very hard to make estimates on these matters. I did a bit of Googling because, I was looking for information about this, scientific information, and there was an interesting thing. Louis Farrakhan's outfit, the Nation of Islam, organised a demo in Washington called the Million Man March back in 97. And then the US Park Service, who were responsible for estimating numbers officially for the government, then reported the attendance as 400,000. And Louis Farrakhan hit the roof and said he'd sue. And then a court appointed a team of geographers from Boston University, whose expertise is counting trees on satellite photographs, to use some of their techniques to count the demonstration. And what I thought was very interesting was that they did the photographic analysis, and they eventually came up with a number which was actually 800,000 plus or minus 20%. And the reason why it's so imprecise is because in what looks like a densely packed crowd, you can actually have densities of up to 6 people per square metre going through to 2 per 6 square metres. So although it's actually very difficult if you're on the ground to estimate this, and I presume the police used their helicopter. I mean, there was a helicopter on the demonstration, but I don't know, and I wasn't able to reach the police to discuss it. But I think it's a point we should return to in the future. Listen, Chris, thanks very much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Have I got time just to say one thing on the
very briefly.
The police estimate on February the 15th, 2003, the first police estimate was 90,000.
Right.
And now everyone accepts that it was a million.
Well, I could come back at you with a story on that demo. I went to the police. I was actually at one point was quite worried about Crush, and I said to one of the policemen who was just standing, you know, a rank and file policeman, I'm a bit worried. I want to get off this demonstration. It's too big. I'm a bit worried there's going to be some kind of crowd stampede. And he said, don't worry, sir. And he said, but it is a bit bigger than we expected.
Yeah. No, but I mean, you know, the idea that the BBC would, which they've admitted to us publicly that they did, that they just took uncritically the police estimate this time round, you know, I mean, that's a joke, really, because the fact of the matter is, on February the 15th, you know, they got it wildly wrong. It was less than, it was a tenth, that their estimate was a tenth the size of the demonstration. So, you know, we can't take the police estimate seriously.
Chris, thank you very much indeed for your comments. Keep us posted on the progress of your complaint. I think this is an issue that we should follow up again in future.
Brilliant. So, well, thanks very much for inviting me.
Yeah, thanks very much. Bye.
All right, mate.
Cheers.
Bye.
Now we're going to have a song from Sam.
Yeah, today I've got a war song about a soldier and his true love being parted. It's called The Manchester Angel. It comes from the Oxford Penguin Book of English folk songs from around the Victorian era. In coming down from Manchester to gain me liberty, I met one of the prettiest girls that ever my eyes did see. I met one of the prettiest girls that ever my eyes did see. At the Angel Inn in Manchester, that is the girl for me. And early next morning, just at the break of day, I went unto my love's bedside, my morning vows to pay. I hugged her, I cuddled her, I bid her lie be warm. She said, me jolly soldier, do you mean me any harm? To mean you any harm, me love, is a thing that I would scorn. If I's to stop all night with you, I'd marry you in the morn. Before my lawful officers, my vows I will fulfill. She said, me jolly soldier, you may lie as long as you will. Our route came on Thursday, on Monday we marched away. The drums and fifes and bugles, so sweetly they did play. Some hearts, they were merry, but mine was filled with woe. She says, may I go along with you? Oh no, me love, oh no. If you should stand on Century on a cold and bitter day, your colours, they would fade, me love, and your beauty would decay. If I saw you handle a musket, love would fill my heart with woe. So stay at home, dear Nancy, but still she answered no. I'll go down to your office, sir, and I'll buy your love discharge. 10 guineas I'll surrender if they'll set you at large. And if that will not do me, love, along with you I'll go. So will you take me with you now? And still I answered no. And I'll go down to some nunnery, and there I'll end my life. I'll never have no lover, nor yet become a wife. But constant and true-hearted love forever I'll remain. And I'll never will get married till my soldier comes again. That's the Manchester Angel.
Excellent. Thanks very much. Meanwhile, this week, the CPS in Brighton dropped yet another controversial criminal case against an anti-arms trade protester in Brighton, a legal observer who was arrested for using a video camera at a demonstration outside Edo MBM in June last year, an alleged breach of the anti-protest injunction then in force, has had all charges against him dropped. In February, Edo dropped their interim injunction against protests after a long legal battle by campaigners in the High Court. The case would have involved a Crown Court jury trial, and the legal observer faced a possible 5-year prison sentence if found guilty. In June last year, he was remanded to HMP Lewis for nearly a week after his arrest, despite the fact that he has had no criminal record. The dropping of the case follows the dropping of charges against 30 other protesters related to protests at Edo over the last few months there. For more, see smashedo.org.uk.
The week-long Fourth World Water Forum ends today in Mexico City under the auspices of a dialogue for better water stewardship amongst government agencies, government-friendly NGOs, private companies and other institutions. Forum participants have to be discussing the increasingly scarce future of water and who has access to it. Campaigners say that essentially 320 corporations, government agencies and international financial institutions like the World Bank have been negotiating the privatisation of public water markets to open them up for lucrative business ventures. Currently, 1 billion people do not have access to potable water, and estimates suggest that by 2025, two-thirds of the world's population will be gravely impacted by water scarcity. In response to the forum, Mexican civil society has organised a boycott against the forum and instead engaged in a week of resistance and education led by the Coalition of Mexican Organisations for Water Rights, which was formed in 2005, to demand the access of water as a guaranteed human right and its management in a democratic, sustainable, just and equal manner. The Alternative International Forum in Defence of Water involved testimonies from people all over the globe and included Indigenous peoples, forums, workshops for better grassroots organisation to protect water as a human right. On March 16th, the opening day of the main forum, a large demonstration of tens of thousands of people was met by provocation and violence from the police. 27 people were unjustly arrested, while dozens of others were beaten and harassed. For more, see the feature on Global Indie Media at indiemedia.org.
And that was the incomparable Lester Bowie's track, A Waterfall. Now, a new asylum and immigration detention centre is to be built at Gatwick Airport to replace the Oakington Centre in Cambridgeshire, which is due to be closed this September. The Home Office said BAA Linton, on behalf of the Airport Property Partnership, would seek planning consent for the airport site, with the detention centre expected to open in 2008. It will have about 420 places for male and female detainees, replacing the Oakington Centre, which had a total of 400 places. The move comes at a time when asylum applications are at their lowest level since 1994 and deportations are on the increase. There are currently 10 detention centres in the UK with 2,545 places in total. Seven of them are run by private companies. Increasingly, the so-called immigration removal centres are being located near airports, such as two at Heathrow and one at Gatwick. Meanwhile, a demonstration in Harmansworth Detention Centre has been called for April the 8th in solidarity with a worldwide call for action from Australian No Border Access. activists.
Four toy seals narrowly escaped seizure by police under Section 5 of the Public Order Act last weekend during a protest in Worcester. 10 campaigners were leafleting in the centre of town against the forthcoming Canadian seal cull, where up to 300,000 seals will be slaughtered for their fur pelts. Overreacting, the local police deployed 7 officers and ordered the demonstration dispersed under Section 14, threat of arrest. All because of 4 small toy seals with fake blood on the fur that police said were distressing shoppers. The campaigners complied with the order to end their protest, but ended up receiving even more publicity when the local paper ran a front page story on the cops' crackdown on cuddly toys. This incident followed hot on the heels of a Herefordshire police being ridiculed 3 weeks ago for seizing 3 gollywog dolls in nearby Bromyard.
Okay, and it's just time to say that this Saturday sees a benefit for London Hack Labs, dubbed the Digital Resistance. The event is organised by the London Hack Labs Collective and sees live roots reggae and dub punk music. And before that, there are workshops in the afternoon from 1 p.m, films from 6 p.m, and then live music and DJs from 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. That's this Saturday, the 25th of March, from 1 p.m. to 1 a.m. at Ramparts, which is at 15 Rampart Street, E1. For more, see rampart.co.nr. And Sam's got an announcement.
And on Wednesday, the 29th of March, that's next Wednesday, there will be the opening of a folk club night hosting lots of new and old folk music at the Old Queen's Head, 44 Essex Road. It's music from 8 o'clock. Hope to see you there.
So if you want a song sung on a political issue from an encyclopedic source, then just go along to that one. We're now going to play out with John Perkins, who's written a book called The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and Zoe's been along to interview him.
My name is John Perkins. I was an economic hitman. We economic hitmen built a global empire, the first truly global empire in the history of the world. And basically, we cheated countries around the world out of trillions of dollars and funneled the money that was lent to those countries by the World Bank into major U.S. corporations and a few very wealthy families in the Third World. At the same time, we put the countries in the Third World so deep into debt that they couldn't possibly pay back the debt and owed us favors. So when we needed oil cheap from those countries, or UN votes in our favor, or land for military bases, or wanted them to send troops in support of us to Iraq or someplace else, we went back in and said, look, you borrowed a lot of money from us, you owe us a lot of money, you can't repay us, therefore give us this favor, sell us your oil real cheaply. That's what economic hitmen do. Economic hitmen work in many different ways, but probably the most typical is that we identify a developing country that has a resource that we covet, let's say oil. And we arrange then for one of the major banks or a coalition of them, usually with the World Bank as the lead, to lend that country a lot of money. Most of the money then goes to companies in the United States, ones that we've heard the names of, like the Bechtels and the Halliburtons, to build major infrastructure projects, power plants, harbors, industrial parks, that serve the very rich in that developing country. And very little of the money actually finds its way into the country itself. But the country is left holding a huge debt that it can't possibly repay. So at some point we go back into the country and say, look, you owe us all this money, you can't repay your debt, therefore sell our oil companies your oil very cheaply. Even if that means destroying your rainforests, your indigenous cultures, you owe us this debt. Sell us your resource, oil, whatever, at a very cheap price. From my experience, the organizations like the World Bank and the IMF and other major international aid agencies and banking institutions basically serve the interests of building empire. And to a large degree, this empire has been built by the United States, although there's other countries involved. We're kind of like the CEO of the empire. And these organizations, these banks, which were originally set up to reconstruct a devastated world after World War II, very quickly became politicized. And part of reconstructing that devastated world was showing the world that our system was better than the Soviet Union system, that capitalism was better than communism. So almost from the beginning, these banks became politicized. over time, they very much became the vehicles of American corporations, what I call the corporatocracy, which are really the people who run this empire. These are the heads of our big corporations and our government and our bank, and they often jump back and forth between these very high-level positions in those organizations. And the banks essentially are set up to serve their interests, to help them become more wealthy and more powerful. If you really believe that the bank is out there to help poor people, then you've got to get rid of the loans. But if the bank is out there to serve the interests of the empire, which it has done for the last 50 years, then keeping the loans serves the best interests of that empire. I think it's essential that people around the world, and people in the developing world especially, speak out, demand that the debts be dropped, demand that the banks stop making these outrageous loans. Argentina is taking a lead in that now, and several other Latin American countries have also expressed the opinion that they really don't owe this money, that the money was forced on them, and they really don't owe this money, that a few of their corrupt leaders signed off on these debts. Ecuador is such a country, and Bolivia, and Colombia, and Peru have expressed these things too, that their people really don't owe these debts, that corrupt leaders accepted the money and became personally wealthy in the process, and in many cases took the money overseas, what they made by real estate in Miami or put it in Swiss banks, and many of them have actually left the country. So the people of these countries are saying, we don't owe this money. And in fact, if I were a banker and I were to go to someone out there, you, and coerce you or seduce you into accepting a loan from me, and I knew full well you could never repay that loan, but I want you to accept it so I can ask a favor of you later, that would be a criminal act on my part. You'd be able to get out from under the loan, and I would be tried as a criminal. In the international monetary world, that's not the case. We write the laws. The empire writes the laws, and the laws allow this to go on an international basis. I don't think there's any moral hazard at all in forgiving loans that have been basically made illegally and immorally. They're not, strictly speaking, illegal, because we write the laws. But from any reasonable standpoint, they should be illegal, and they're certainly immoral. So to say that to forgive that debt would be an immoral act, would be encouraging people to take on debt without repaying it, is absurd, because the people who are having to pay off these debts, the ones who are suffering, are the poor in all these countries. The money is coming out of their pockets. They're not getting education, they're not getting health services, they're not getting other social services because of this debt payment. I've seen statistics that indicate that the Philippines has to pay 85% of its annual income. It has to go to paying off these foreign debts. That's completely immoral. It's the poor people who suffer. So the rich people have received the benefits from these loans, and now the poor people are suffering because that money's not available for their education and for their health care and to provide them with food and other social services. So to perpetuate the system is immoral. To drop those debts would be a highly moral thing to do. And at the same time, we would have to make sure that this isn't replicated. We don't just drop the debts and then encourage the countries to begin all over again and get into the vicious cycle all over again. In dropping the debts, you also have to do away with the whole system that has set this up and has been building since the end of World War II. A good example of the way economic hitmen work, I think, is Panama under Omar Torrijos, who was the president that negotiated the Canal Treaty with Jimmy Carter. And I personally went into Panama, and I talk about this in detail in Confessions of an Economic Hitman, but in summary version, Torrijos told me, look, I'm not going to buy the deal that you have. I know what you want to do. I know basically you want to put us in deep debt, and I know that if I go along with the system, I'll become wealthy. But that's not what I want. What I want is for my poor people to be better off. And so, in fact, in that case, we did do some projects in Panama that helped the very poor. We showed that foreign aid can be used in a good way. But I was also very aware that I was failing as an economic hitman. I wasn't bringing Torrijos around. And I was always aware that when we economic hitmen fail, which doesn't happen too often, but when we fail, what we call the jackals, which are CIA-sanctioned assassins who will usually go in and try first of all to create a coup in a country, but if that doesn't work, they'll assassinate presidents or heads of state. And in fact, I was aware that I was failing as an economic hitman, that, that Torrijos was refusing to go along with the system, and therefore he was in for trouble. And in fact, he died in a fiery airplane crash that has all the markings of a CIA assassination. Now, when both the economic hitmen and the jackals fail, then as a last resort, does the U.S. military go in. And that's what happened in Iraq. In Iraq, we tried to emulate the plan that we've been so successful in imposing upon the House of Saud, the royal family of Saudi Arabia. We were very successful with that plan. And so we tried to do the same thing with Saddam Hussein in Iraq, but Saddam didn't go along. The jackals then tried to remove him or assassinate him. They couldn't. His security forces were too loyal, and he had lots of doubles. So we attacked in 1990. And at that point, just basically destroyed his military and thought he was sufficiently chastised that now he would come around. And so we tried all over again. The economic hitmen went in again, failed again, he wouldn't come around. The jackals couldn't take him out, so we sent the military in once again, more recently. That's kind of the way this whole system works, is that the empire is built primarily on economic hitmen, but when we don't succeed, the CIA-sanctioned jackals go in. If they don't succeed, then as a last resort, the military goes in. Well, I'm a citizen of the United States, and my family goes back over 300 years. We have family members who fought in the Revolution, fought in every major war the United States has fought, and I consider myself to be a very loyal American, and I detest the way our government and our corporatocracy right now is running the system. We must get the word out to the American people, and I use that term advisedly because all the people in South and Central America are Americans. When I'm using that term incorrectly almost, I'm referring to people in the United States, really. It's a difficult concept here. How do you say the people from the United States need to get the message. I'm so struck as I travel around the world. I was recently in Nepal, in Tibet, and in Brazil at the World Social Forum. I travel a great deal, and I'm struck by how many people that we think of as uneducated, even illiterate, know that this is going on. They know that their countries have received billions of dollars. They know that a few people in their country have made lots of money, and they know that American companies are in there building huge projects and making a lot of money, and they know they're not benefiting. In fact, the poor are getting poorer relative to the rich in many of these countries, and they know it. They're suspicious, they're skeptical. They know their governments are corrupt, they know the United States government is corrupt, and they're angry. But as I travel around my own country, the United States, I'm shocked by how many people don't know this. The American people have had the wool pulled over our eyes. We need to change this. So frequently, people in the United States will say, well, you know, we give all this foreign aid to these countries, and then they turn on us. They're angry at us. They don't like us. What's going on here? They don't realize that we're not giving foreign aid, that foreign aid is very seldom altruistic. There are some exceptions when it is altruistic, after a tsunami, for example. But for the most part, foreign aid is not altruistic at all, but the American public doesn't understand this. So the first step is that we must educate the people of the United States as to what is really happening with their tax money, where are the profits from the corporations that they're supporting with their purchases of goods and services, where those profits are going. It's very important that we educate the people from the United States, and that's why I wrote the book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, even though I was under a lot of pressure not to write it. I had to take an oath of secrecy when I became an economic hitman. But after September 11th, and seeing what happened at September 11th, I went up to Ground Zero shortly afterwards, and as I stood there and saw that smoking pit and could actually smell burning flesh still, it was so close, I realized that this story had to be told, because September 11th was a terrible, terrible tragedy, a mass murder. There's no excuse for it, but it's just the beginning. It's a symbol of a very serious illness in this world, and of a tremendous amount of hatred that's resulted from a very unjust system. And to some degree, that hatred is very justified. And I'm not saying that something like what happened on September 11th is justified, but the anger underlying that that's felt by so many people around the world at the United States often is very justified. and we need to change it. And in order to change it, the American people, the people of the United States, have to understand what's going on in the world, what our country is doing. As an economic hitman, I was not doing anything illegal for the most part, a few minor infractions, but for the most part, what I did was legal. And in fact, sanctioned by business schools that teach us that that's the way to do things. My official title was chief economist of Charles T. Maine, a very reputable consulting firm in Boston at the time. Since then, it's gone out of existence. I had a staff of several dozen people working for me, highly skilled, PhDs, MBAs. The culture that I was in was a culture that's very much sanctioned by the and legitimatized by the business schools, the law schools, the World Bank, etc. And so we actually could take pride in our work if we looked at it intellectually. And it's easy to be in denial that you know, and to convince yourself you're doing good things. But in fact, I knew all along in my heart that what we were doing was devastating to poor people, that this was not the right way to do it. And in fact, I only did it actively for about 10 years, and then I had enough. I had to get out, but I stayed on the fringes for many years and didn't tell the story, which I always felt I should tell the story. It needed to be told. But from the standpoint of what is it like to be an economic hitman, from a personal standpoint, it's very easy for a person to convince himself in that position that he's doing good things. But it's also, I think most people in that role, at least in my case, deep in my heart, I knew that we shouldn't be doing this. I think people are drawn into this type of work. A, it's not illegal. It's praised. And B, you get what I think are the three biggest drugs of our culture, which are money, power, and sex. There's a lot of all of those. And in my case, I always got to travel first class and fly in the bump of the 747s and stay in the best hotels and eat in the best restaurants. And I talk in the book a lot about the background I came from that made this appear to me to be very, to be the realization of a dream that I'd had since I was young, to travel around the world living the good life. And so people are drawn in by that, and also by the fact that it's very much sanctioned by our education system and by the things that we're brought up to believe in. And that's so true of many people who work in the corporations. There's a lot of people in corporations like Bechtel and Halliburton and in the World Bank and in Monsanto and Nike that believe, that can convince themselves that they're doing good things because there's a whole apparatus set up to convince them of this. Psychologists, human resource specialists, financial specialists, even lawyers that are there to tell people like me that we're doing the right thing. This is the best thing for the world. This is helping progress. And so it's very, very easy to hide from this. And I think the system, we need to face this system head on, and we need to expose it for what it is. And that's why I wrote the book, so that it makes it much more difficult for people to work for Monsanto or General Electric or Nike or Walmart and go out there and exploit others and convince themselves that they're really doing good. Our whole system in the United States is built on this empire. We've created an amazing empire since the end of World War II. It's the history's first truly global empire, created primarily without the military. So it's very subtle. When you create an empire, as the Romans did, or the Greeks, or the conquistadores, or the Portuguese, or the Germans or the British Empire, when you create empires with military, everybody knows you're doing it. Your young people are going off to war. But when you do it as we've done it through economics, it's easy for a lot of people to be in denial and not to know that this is happening. And yet, all of our pension funds, all of our life savings and everything, the stock market is supporting this system. It's next to impossible to invest in any kind of a fund. I don't care what the fund says about its social responsibilities and so on. It's very, very difficult today in the United States to put money anywhere as a savings that earns back interest where you're not supporting these organizations. What are people to do about that? It's a very, very difficult question. Do you take all your money out and put it under the bed? That doesn't make sense either. What we really need to do is get to the roots of this system and let it be known that we no longer are going to accept this. We are no longer going to accept our corporations going over and exploiting other countries and poor people. We just are not going to accept it. We're not going to buy those goods and services. We need to get that word out there. We're not going to accept a situation where the heads of our government come out of any of these industries. It's absurd to think that the watchdogs for various industries came from the top of those industries, and after they leave government, they'll go back to those industries. I mean, that's just the grounds for corruption. It's a conflict of interest, clearly. We need to put an end to that sort of thing. We also need to put an end to the idea that chief executive officers of a corporation have the right to make, right now they're making on average 300 times more than their average employees. I mean, that's absurd. They're not contributing 300 times more than those employees. The system is basically rotten at the core, and corporations can certainly serve a purpose, but it needs to be a much more compassionate purpose that takes care of the employees, that takes care of the clients, the customers, and that takes care of the suppliers, and doesn't give such amazing windfall profits to a few very wealthy owners, people who primarily own the corporations, and the executives at the top. There's no reason for this. It's created a very difficult situation, and it's creating a world that's in crisis, a world that's angry, a world where 24,000 people starve to death or die of malnutrition every single day. I mean, that's just totally unacceptable. We need to change that. And I'm very optimistic that we are going to change it. We see tremendous cracks in the system. The fact that my book is selling so well, the fact that I'm talking on this television right now, and that there's so many people interested in this and concerned about it, tells us that people want change. And we're seeing tremendous cracks in the system all over the world. So the system's going to collapse. Empires never succeed in the long run. We know that. History tells us that every empire has always collapsed, and when it collapses violently. And so the alternative for us right now is to turn this thing around and say, look, we've created this global empire, but in the process we've also created tremendous resources. We've created tremendous channels of communication and distribution, and we can reverse the flow so that this empire is not just like a great octopus sucking resources from every corner of the world, but instead it can send out through those same tentacles, those same channels, it can send out compassion. It can send food to those who need food, or the means of producing food. Teach them how to produce food, and water, and clothes, and shelter. It'll be a first in the history of mankind for an empire to do that, and yet I think we're ready. And all the indigenous prophecies, there's prophecies from around the world that tell us that this is a very special time we've entered right now. We call it the Age of Aquarius, or the third millennium, but all the indigenous cultures that I've worked with over the years predict that right now is a time when we have the potential for tremendous change, and I think we're feeling that happening. I think we can use these systems that we've set up to create something that truly reflects a deep-seated belief in the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all people around the world. You know, the United States most sacred document talks about government of the people, for the people, and by the people. Right now, we've got a government of the corporations, for the corporations, and by the corporations. We need to change that and embrace a worldwide concept of societies around the world of the people, for the people, and by the people. I know people at the World Bank and in big corporations that are absolutely sitting up and taking notice. And I think sometimes those people that go to these gatherings, like Seattle in 99, walk away and think that they've been forgotten. They haven't been forgotten. That registers. It makes a huge impression. We have to remember that the people running these big corporations and the big banks are people. And they have children. And they have grandchildren. And most of them they all think of themselves as good people. And they want to do what's right, but they don't know what's right. And they're scared, and they're afraid that if they rock the boat, they'll simply lose their job, and they won't accomplish anything anyway. So it's all the social movements that support change and that insist upon change help these people see the right way and give them an excuse to move in that direction. So that if you're getting tremendous pressure, if you're a corporate executive, for example, and people are boycotting your organization, then you've got a real good excuse to go to your stockholders or your board of directors and say, look, we've got to change our ways. Whereas if nobody's boycotting you, if nobody's speaking out against your policies in the rainforest or or with whales or whatever, if nobody's speaking out against that, you can just keep doing what you're doing. And if you try to change it, your stockholders would probably throw you out. But if somebody steps up to the plate and says, look, we're no longer going to buy the products from this company because of the way it's treating whales or the rainforest or polluting rivers, then it gives the executives an opportunity to go to their stockholders and say, look, we have to change in order to survive. So the social movements and the civil movements around the world, the social organizations, can have a very large impact. We need to keep speaking out constantly, making demands. I encourage young people to get out into the world, to learn more about the world, to visit other countries, to live in other cultures, to learn other languages, because in learning other languages you learn a different way of thinking, and to devote themselves not to things that are just going to make them wealthy materialistically, but to things that will make them wealthy in their heart. And I'd like to make it very clear that I am extremely optimistic that things are going to change. When I wrote the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, I knew I was sticking my head in a noose. I was taking a big risk. I was sworn to secrecy. I put off writing this book for many years. As I talk, I tell in the book about some threats that I had and bribes not to write the book. And finally, when I wrote it, I knew I was taking a risk, but I'm not suicidal and I'm not self-destructive, and so the only reason I would take such a risk is if I feel in my heart that we really can change. I have a 22-year-old daughter. I just turned 60, and I know that, I don't know whether I've got another day left of my life or whether I've got another 30 years left, but what I do know is that when I'm on my deathbed, I want to be able to look back and say, I spent the last years of my life making this a better world for my daughter and her generation of people her age and her children's age all over the world, not just in the United States. We can't do that. It's got to be for the whole world. And I really know that we can do this. Right now, I'd be leaving my daughter a worse world than the one I inherited from my parents. I don't want to see that happen. And I know that we've created these systems that we've created, this empire we've created, so that we can use it to move forward into a much more compassionate world, a world where we can share the resources and the ideologies of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness for all people, that we can share those with everyone around the world. There's no reason why people should have to flee other countries, like, say, Haiti or any other country, and go to the United States to find work, to find what they consider to be freedom. We can spread that. We can spread those concepts. We can make sure that people stay in their own beautiful countries and have these opportunities. But the fact of the matter, right now, our corporatocracy is causing a lot of the problems in these countries. So the very first step is that we must clamp down and change the system that we've created, this banking system, this system of debt, the system of big corporations that are acting as bullies around the world. We must put an end to that. That's the first step, is putting an end to that. And as we do that, this will open up the world to a very different aspect. I think we truly have reached a point where we can realize the prophecies of the Mayas, of the Quechua, of the Bushmen and the Zulus, and of the Buganese people of Sulawesi, Indonesia. All of these prophecies say that we've reached a time where the people of the South and the people of the North, the people of the heart and the people of the brain or mind can come together and rise up to a new level of consciousness where we can bring our entire species to a new level of consciousness. I think we've truly reached that time, and we all need to push hard to make sure that it happens.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.